This is Red Eyes Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Nice to have you with us. If you are listening for the first time, a warm welcome. My name is Henrik Palmgren. RedEyesCreations.com is our website where we have frequently updated news, our radio archive, videos, film, links, resources, and much more. We are based out of Sweden, Scandinavia. We discuss and highlight everything from conspiracy and spirituality to the occult, the esoteric, new technology and science, philosophy, history, secret societies, geopolitics, religion, and so much more. We are here doing radio interviews on Thursdays and Sundays with interesting guests for your consideration. We do not tell you what to think or what you should believe. We try to present the information in the best way we can to help highlight the research of authors, filmmakers, and other researchers and bring their information to your attention. And ultimately, we think that you should make up your own mind about the subjects that we cover, question the material, and of course, continue the search for yourself if you find it interesting. I also want to mention here at the beginning that on Sunday, the 28th of September, at 7 p.m. GMT, we are going to start up Red Eyes Live, and that means audio and video feeds from our studio. And this is going to be more like TV than radio. This is interviews with clips, film excerpts, images, videos, photographs, or other graphs for that matter, any kind of visual aid that we can use in order to go even deeper in explaining the many subjects that we cover on this radio program. And our first guest will be Daniel Tatman. We'll go further into architecture and symbolism, and this is going to be really awesome. We'll be able to show you some of the stuff that we've been talking about with Daniel during our mini-series. So this is a whole new level to Red Eyes. You might have seen the first live program that we did several months ago. Well, this is going to be so much more than that. We thought that we could do a whole lot better, and we have. So we've gotten a whole new system that will enable us to have a whole lot more freedom when it comes to what content we'll be able to run during the live programs. So click on the Red Eyes Live banner on our front page, redeyescreations.com, and you can read more about this. So again, on Sunday, the 28th of September at 7 p.m. GMT, we want you to tune in live as we're going to start this up nice and easy. So that's going to be really interesting starting that up again. Okay, so today we are going to talk about all things 2012, theories, prophecies, and prediction. We have author and researcher Jeff Stray with us. He is the author of Beyond 2012, Catastrophe or Ecstasy, a complete guide to the end of time predictions. I also heard Ian Crane mention last time we had him on the program that there is a pocket version available with the title 2012 in your pocket, I believe. And we're going to talk about these books, of course, later on in the program. I also want to mention, of course, that Jeff is behind the website diagnosis2012.co.uk. And if you've done any searching at all online about 2012, you've bound to have stumbled across some material over at diagnosis2012.co.uk. It's a vast resource with tons of material about everything and around 2012. Highly recommended. Head on over there and do check it out. It's great stuff up there for you. So with that, let's say welcome to our guest. Jeff, thanks for coming on Red Eyes Creations Radio. Very nice of you to join us today.
Well, thanks very much, Henrik. It's good to be here.
You know, many years ago, I stumbled across your website. I've spent many hours reading articles and entries posted on your site. And I'd love to hear a little bit about your background, you know, primarily kind of what sparked your interest. And also, of course, when you started up your website and what kind of motivated you to do that.
Well, it was back in 1982. I'd been reading the Illuminatus trilogy by Robert Anton Wilson, and I managed to get hold of Cosmic Trigger, The Final Secret of the Illuminati, which was the book in which he explained all the weird stuff that led him to write the trilogy and the stuff that happened during writing it and after writing it, the coincidences and synchronicities. And in that book, there was a section where he summarized the work of Terence and Dennis McKenna in their book, The Invisible Landscape. And I was so fascinated by that summary. I tried to get hold of a copy of that book, and it took me 10 months to get it in the end. And I managed to get it from the library, but they only let me have it for a week, so I had to photocopy the book. And I was studying it for the next 5 years, actually, on and off. And it was in 1987 when I was reading it for the third time that I found that José Arguelles had produced this book called The Maya Factor, The Mayan Factor.
Yes.
And, there we have, I mean, Arguelles had made the point, I mean, McKenna had made the point in The Invisible Landscape that the I Ching was, I'll explain what it was about. Basically, they went. Him and Dennis, his brother, went down to the Ecuador rainforest to try and sample some ayahuasca before anyone but anthropologists had heard about it. And the combination that they had in the end, I mean, as you know, this is a hallucinogenic brew that the shamans down in the rainforests use.
Yes.
To access altered states of consciousness. And they'd heard this story that... that out of the pores and orifices of the shamans comes this luminous blue substance that they can mold into a magical kind of material that they use to perform their magic with, but it's only visible to those who've also partaken of the brew. So they were so fascinated, they tried to get down there and sample it. And they actually ended up having they smoked the skin of the vine, the ayahuasca vine, and combined it with psilocybin mushroom. It was quite a close chemical approximation of what people have when they have the ayahuasca brew, because psilocybin is a close relative of dimethyltryptamine, the active constituent in that they put in the brew from various plants, depending on what area of the rainforest they're operating from.
Yes.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, Dennis was so fascinated by what had happened that he became a psychopharmacologist to try and explain how they'd accessed all this information from the nucleus of the DNA and how the drug molecule opens up the DNA and accesses that information from the nucleus. That's what fascinated him. But Terence was fascinated by the information they got, explaining that all that happens in the universe is encoded into the ancient Chinese oracle, the I Ching, which is the Book of Changes. So he went back to USA and hired what was then a very advanced computer, and they basically converted all the information in the King Wen sequence of the I Ching into an equation, and then converted the equation into a graph and fractalized the graph so the same pattern was encapsulated within it at smaller and smaller levels, so it would then explain all the change in the universe from subatomic event levels right up to the level where you have the beginning of time to the end of time. So once they'd done that, they then had to calculate where we were on the wave, and they did that by correlating a big peak on the wave to the explosion of the bomb at Hiroshima in 1945. And then there's 384 lines in the I Ching, 6 times 64, because it's 64 hexagrams of 6 lines each, which are each a combination of yin and yang.
Yes.
And so the 384 lines, McKenna sort of made a good case that those were originally a lunar calendar, 384 days in 13 lunar months, so like one lunar year. So you had a lunar calendar from China. And once they'd correlated this big peak near the end of the wave to this explosion of the Hiroshima bomb, it was exactly 384-day years after that point on the wave that the wave hits the baseline. And that's maximum novelty. And that only happens twice on the whole wave, at the beginning, at the end, which theoretically he thought was the beginning of time and the end of time.
Yes.
And so 384-day years after that event in 1945 brought them to the 17th of November 2012. And the whole thing fascinated me, and I got to studying it. But then when 5 years later, I was looking at it for the third time, and then came across The Mayan Factor by José Arguelles, that showed that there was this solar-based calendar system from the other side of the world that's over 3,000 years. Well, it's well over 2,000 years old anyway, depending on what stories you believe, but or whether you take it back to the beginning of the Olmecs. But It's over 2,000 years old, but the I Ching from the other side of the world is a lunar system, according to McKenna's findings, which is well over 4,000 years old, and they're both terminating within 34 days of each other. So when McKenna later found out about the Maya calendar, he then brought out the new edition of his book in 1993 and sort of updated the endpoint to coincide with the Maya calendar. So, I mean, that's what... When I realised in 87 that there was two systems from the opposite side of the world with this amazing coincidental endpoint, that's what set me off on the search to find out if there's any other ancient sources or places that this may have been recorded.
Mm. Yeah, because I guess most people that have in some way or another encountered 2012 obviously think about the end of the Mayan calendar, but as you say, there are so many more sources that seem to point towards this date, of course. I mean, if we were to talk about, for instance, you know, the overview of the theories that are out there, we could either talk about what potentially could be happening at the end date or what have you. If we assume that we're talking here to someone who never heard about 2012 before, is there any kind of easy way to explain to them in a nutshell, if you will, what 2012 is about and what the potential end date is all about?
Well, what we have really is a collection of theories about what it could be, and some of them are more convincing than others. Some theories, as I found, were based on faulty information, and they can, although most of these ideas have some validity in them, I mean, there's no point in throwing out the whole of something because there's a mistake in it. Sometimes,
of course, yeah.
They've discovered something important, although they've made a big mistake. But yeah, some of them are more convincing than others, and the most convincing ones are the ones that sort of tie up prophecies, theories, and astronomical facts. Those are the ones that really seem to sort of the ones that I find more compelling.
Mm-hmm.
So, very often people do say to me, in a nutshell, can you sum it all up in a couple of sentences? Well, a couple of sentences is quite difficult.
Yes.
But I do have some, I got some favourite scenarios because they're, you know, some favourite bits that all seem to fit together.
Yeah, it must be, of course. I mean, have you been like into this on a full-time basis or kind of a hobby basis since basically 1982 or 87 then, is that correct?
Yes, I was around about, but from 82 to 87, I was just studying the invisible landscape.
Right.
And from 87 onwards, I was looking into Maya material and looking for other outcroppings of this in writings. So I was going into bookshops and looking through bookshelves and looking through the indexes and scanning them, just trying to find anything that might refer to this endpoint, or sort of looking at prophecies of all sorts, anywhere there might be some information.
And much of this material, of course, you have gathered at your website. When did you first start up Diagnosis 2012?
That was started in September of year 2000. Yeah, I kind of held back over the Y2K period, year 2000, because there were all these stories that there was going to be a big computer meltdown. So I held off till after 2000, and from February, March 2000, when I bought the computer, until September, that's when I was putting it all together from all my notes. And then, of course, and I'd been going in internet cafes and surfing in internet cafes for a couple of years as well. So I'd got quite a lot of leads to follow up on the net. And by that point, I joined a crop circle club in Sussex in 1997. And here was a bunch of people who were open-minded enough to actually be interested in what I was discovering. And I just started off printing out A4 collections of I summarized everything I'd discovered into little bite-sized paragraphs, put it on these A4 leaf things, which I stuck together with a staple, and just started handing them out to people to stimulate some discussion. Because at that point, there was only one person I'd found that I'd actually managed to speak to who'd heard of the I Ching 2012 termination point and the Maya calendar termination point. That person was Robert Anton Wilson. I spoke to him at one of his talks and brought it up. And yes, and he was aware of it and the amazing coincidence.
Right.
Or synchronicity there, that there must be something meaningful behind it. But yes, at the same time, he's very tongue-in-cheek, you know, reticent to commit himself. The man had an amazing mind. It was a great influence on me.
I've been going back, actually, over some of Robert Anton Wilson's, watching some of his lectures and listening to some of his talks again, and I haven't actually read yet too much of his material, but I definitely very much, you know, resonate, so to speak, with Robert Anton Wilson and his kind of overarching philosophy. So I'm glad you highlighted that, because it's very timely for me too, you know. So
yeah, in his whole modus operandi was not to be, well, basically it's actually a little similar. I mean, he did investigate Crowley as well, but Crowley, one of the Crowley's sayings was when he was in the, not that I'm a Crowleyist or anything, but he said when he was in charge of the Astrum Argentum, I think it was, we place no reliance on prophet or pigeon. Our method is science. Our aim is religion.
That's a good one. Yeah. There we go. Yeah.
So Wilson's sort of method was to immerse yourself into belief systems, but only temporarily, to immerse yourself sufficiently to become subjective about them. But then at the end of the experiment, you withdraw and become objective again. And that way you don't get sucked in, and you can still operate objectively and take on new information without having to have an agenda and start, you know, because yes, when people get attached to any particular theory or idea or viewpoint, then they start to filter in order, anything that doesn't quite match up with it or fit in with it, they start to put that to one side and only concentrate on the things that fit in with it. And that's when things start getting distorted.
It is, exactly. I couldn't agree more. And again, this is more, what I've noticed is that people are also seem to be very interested in devoting themselves to a particular viewpoint or a theory or a religion or what have you, but seldomly they don't want to understand it, you know, and that's a shame.
I think Al Wilson used to say something like, every Thursday afternoon after lunch, you should even start to get your head round the opinions and theories that you hate the most. Keep yourself broad-minded. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a good trick. And I mean, if we apply that to the phenomena as it has become now of 2012, I mean, there's so much information and it's growing by the day. Is it difficult to stay objective when it comes to 2012, you think?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I go through phases of a sort of being attached more to one idea and another idea, and some days I just don't believe anything. overall, yes, I think something is going on here, and you know, it's well beyond coincidence that all these things matching up like this.
Yeah,
but generally speaking, I still don't think there's enough information for us to actually come to a definite conclusion about it. And I think my job, if you like, has been to get people thinking and doing their own research, but to help them along the way by stopping them wasting their time going up blind alleys.
Right.
And so after I got the started doing those A4 leaflets, then it sort of developed into a booklet. Proper staple booklet with little pictures as well, only in black and white, but you know, I was knocking them out for a cost price sort of thing. And then I started, the Crop Circle group asked me to do a talk, and I started doing repeating the talk at other groups, and eventually I started to think about the website. And then so the booklet was basically, what was the first thing on the website, the Beyond 2012 section, is basically based on that A4 booklet, which was called Beyond 2012.
I see. And, you know, One thing that I'd love to ask you here is, as we progress towards this date, December 21st, 2012, we're only soon about 4 years away. And I've probably been following this for, probably since 2001 or two in one form or another. At least the interest began to bubble up at that point, and then I've been more or less immersed in it. And I've obviously had, myself, different theories and ideas of what is going to happen, especially as we progress towards this date. I'd like to ask you, if you think so far, if things have played out as you've expected them to. Maybe you didn't have any expectations to begin with, but I certainly did. And, if you had any expectations, have things gone, faster than you expected, slower, more exciting, or even more boring? What do you think?
I suppose it seems rather slow to me, having sort of looked into it and, looked that far ahead. But the whole thing about this, a lot of these graphs, the time wave is one, and Robert Anton Wilson's analysis is another one. And it was based on a study by Georges Andelard, a Frenchman, and Wilson sort of expanded it greatly over several years, actually. And he concluded, basically, if you take the knowledge at the time of Christ and measure the time it takes to double and double again and double again, you get a graph that goes vertical just after the year 2000. When he finished his survey, Wilson was quite amazed by the fact that all this information he gathered and graphed like this seemed to tie up with McKenna's time wave. And it also seemed to tie up with Peter Russell's ideas of a sort of spiral of time that spirals in on itself into an infinite regress in the center of the spiral, which is a sort of paradox because it represents one moment and it also represents a time going on to infinity. And all these three ideas, although they're separate, they all seem to confirm and support each other. Well, McKenna's time wave, if you look at the points on the wave as you get toward the end of it, each of these levels of the wave, there are 26 levels of a hierarchy of levels, each one being 64 times smaller than the one above it, down to the subatomic event level. If you look at, you're going towards the point where all those peaks together at the end of the graph, and just before they peak is the last peak before they peak, is a sort of threshold. And as you get toward the end of the graph, those thresholds become more and more crushed up together. But most of them are in the last few seconds after all these thousands and millions of years of development. Mm. Most of these changes, which Wilson, in his summary of the McKenna wave, said they were equivalent to the evolutionary step that was taken when life moved out of the sea onto dry land. That's the kind of step we're talking about. And if you're talking about a whole collection of those just collected in the last few seconds of this wave, that also seems to agree with what he'd found himself and with Peter Russell's spiral of time. And it also seems to agree with the spiral, the auric time scale. There's a theory that was put out by Sergei Smeliakov, a Russian mathematician, and he applied the golden section, or phi, to the Mayan long count calendar, and then divided phi into it and into it and into it, and basically you get a phi spiral. And the original one had a problem with it, which I brought to his attention. It was he'd actually, being based in Siberia, his information on the Mayan calendar came solely from Jose Agüel's Mayan factor, and in that book, Agüel's had used old source material where they used, this is pre-calculator days, where the date of the start of the long count calendar was put as 3113 BC. Well, since those days, because to work out dates across the 0 year divide, that's because we in our calendar we have Jesus's theoretical birthday followed by 1 AD and preceded by 1 BC. There's no year zero.
Right.
So to work amounts of years out across that dividing point, you need an extra year like we have on the calculator. So after that point, they started to add a year to BC dates, so that the BC dates are 3114 BC, or would now be for the beginning of this 13 Bacton cycle of the long count. So what Smeliakov had done is he'd realized there was a year missing, and he'd added it on the end, thinking the Maya had made a mistake and the whole thing ended in 2013. So his original 64-page mathematical treatise was a year out in its endpoint. So what he was finding was where the phi spiral comes to a junction point, he called it a bifurcation point, and that correlates to significant historical events and the birth of avatars. In a similar way that on the time wave, the peaks and troughs on the wave correspond to historical events as well.
Yes.
Once I pointed that out to him, it also had to be adjusted, because he hadn't actually realized that it was a spiral that could spiral into itself. Once it had been adjusted, so the spiral didn't actually end in 2037 like in the original, but on the winter solstice of 2012, and this one-year discrepancy was also sorted out within missing year zero, then it was found that the bifurcation points were much closer to their historical events that should be associated with them. And the most incredible one was in the one in 1945 that was only 2 days away from the Trinity test, which is presumably the first nuclear device exploded on this planet. So yes, that brought it into a close relationship with the time wave, because they're both accelerating time systems ending in 2012 and both correlated to our calendar with the explosion of a nuclear bomb. But there again, you've got this acceleration towards the end where the spirals into itself, and you've got this paradox of an infinite regress and a single point in time occurring at the same place.
What do you think that means? Many people have different theories, of course, about this. Do you think that this is solely about man's technological achievements? Is this on a geopolitical scale, or are we talking about evolution of the species here? What do you think?
Yeah, it's kind of split the whole thing into two camps in a way, because this the information, if you analyze the long count calendar of the Maya, which Jenkins has shown is based, the endpoint of it is based upon a galactic alignment, which is the alignment of the winter solstice sun with the galactic equator. Now, that is a process that happens over around 36 years, because basically they were measuring the precession of the equinoxes, because the movement of the solstice sun position closes up slowly over the years onto the galactic equator. So precession moves at the rate of around 72 years for 1 degree. So yes, the sun's half a degree wide. So it's about 36 years that it takes for the sun to actually cross that galactic equator. Mm. Now, that implies that this is a window area. This is something that is a slowish process that takes around 36 years to complete. But, I mean, the Maya actually pinpointed one specific year in that process, which is 2012. So that in itself brings the question, which some people ask, if the center point of this process is halfway through, which according to astronomers, the astronomically exact point where the winter solstice sun crossed the galactic equator exactly was around 1998. So people say, okay, so did the Maya get it wrong then? Did they actually target this in that process and get it sort of 13 or 14 years out? So it seems at first that there might be a point there, but during the course of all my studies, I found a lot of people who've had altered states of consciousness, by that I mean out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, sacred plant experiences, remote viewers, people who've been alien abducted, so to speak, or people who've had lucid dream experiences, or even people who've had hypnotic progression into the future. all these people have come back from these altered states of consciousness speaking specifically about 2012, and they knew nothing about it in many cases beforehand, and I've spoken to several of them. So this implies that there is something specific about that particular year, rather than, you know, that seems to be a focus point in this process.
Yes. But
whether or not it's actually can be seen as a point where time rushes into itself. I mean, the time wave seems to imply, you know, that everything is rushing up to this point, and then bang, it's like everything will be completely different after this one microsecond in time.
Yes. Do you think that's valid? Is it? I mean, can we see it in one way? Because I'm thinking back here. You mentioned a little bit about that after 2000, we were kind of beginning to go into this spiraling process, and this is going to go faster and faster. We can look at some things, of course, like Moore's law when it comes to computers, like the computer revolution, if you will, that things are moving faster and faster on how much information we can process. We have the sequencing of the human genome sometime around or after, slightly after 2000. Biological science, hence, is, you know, speeding up, as it were. Do you think that's a little bit of what we can call, you know, evidence for that, if you will?
Yes, I do, because everything, if you look around us, as you say, everything you can see it in your own lifetime, how things are speeding up. You know, just the amount of time it takes before your your technology goes out of date. You know, if you buy a new DVD player or a computer, it's getting a shorter and shorter time before they're bringing out the next model. Everything like that is speeding up, and a lot of people concur that they sense a speeding up of things as well.
Yes.
I mean, in our grandparents' day, the price of bread didn't change for years on end. But you know, you can see it in your own life. But
sorry to interrupt you, but isn't that also a reflection that this is something that is happening within the human world, so to speak? Because I'm thinking about this, and all the things that are, I think, changing rapidly in that faster and faster pace is all the things that we are creating. It's our markets, it's our technology, our kind of updates, if you will. But nature, as far as I can see, is chugging along nice and easy, just as before. What do you think?
Well, that is true. But then I think we are probably talking about a shift in the human mind more when we come down to it.
Hmm.
I mean, of course, we have an impact on the environment, and they say another thing that is speeding up, so they say, is that there are an amount of creatures now going extinct that is equal to or beyond some of the geological boundaries in the past, where we've had, you know, huge wipeouts of species in the past, and that's visible between the geological strata. There are people saying that we're at a state now where we're that many species are going extinct at the moment. So
yes.
You could say that that's a kind of speeding up, which is not, it's probably, I mean, a lot of those, that could be put down to man's activities on the earth.
Could be, exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, we do have an impact on various other systems on the planet, of course.
Yeah. So you mentioned information and doubling, of course, and at this the tightening, if you will, of this spiral, of this knot, of this fractal ratio. Many people have looked at this when we're approaching this point, then, that this is going to be some kind of singularity, as you mentioned, you know, that this is an instantaneous point from which afterwards, of course, we won't know what is going to happen afterwards, because things will be so radically different. And people talk about the technological singularity, that they talk about a singularity when it comes to some kind of evolution. What do you think about that? Have you been able to pinpoint that, or do you favor one theory above another?
I try to, yeah, this is where the old Robert Anton Wilson approach comes in handy, of trying to hold several models and just seeing them as models for what is going on, because we're always trying to reduce things to something that we can handle. But in fact, I mean, this is one of McKenna's favorite sayings. I think it was JBS Haldane he was quoting. Life is not only stranger than you suppose. It's stranger than you can suppose.
Yeah.
And then he said that gives a lot of permission for supposing. So I think the more able you are to hold several models, I mean, this happens in the quantum world. There's no one model that covers all the phenomena.
Right.
You have to basically use the model that's most appropriate for covering whatever it is you're studying at the time, and but don't get too attached to it and hold back. I think this is all probably all part of the process that we are supposed to, you know, develop our minds in that way, that they can become more broad-minded and able to take on various different concepts.
That is interesting. So do you imply a little bit that this whole phenomena, if you will, of 2012 is could also be, because I've heard many people talk about the idea that you know, we will be able to in some form or another be more participatory, if you will, or creators even of our own reality, if you will. This of course could have its roots in technology if we look at it that way. But it could also be, if we look at it from quantum mechanics or quantum physics, as we begin to understand those concepts more, we also consequently might understand that our what we focus on, what type of world we want to live in, that is very much part of this. And after that point, after 2012, that could be one of the reasons why, you know, I've heard remote viewers have difficulty, you know, peering through beyond 2012 and looking after that point and so forth, because things seem to be just a blurred, because the possibility here I'm getting at is that there could be so many different variations and so many different paths that people go down on, that the journey after this point will be very much individual journey. What do you think about a concept like that?
Well, I think this is why it's important to try and I mean, I don't believe in putting your head in the sand. That's why I've looked at all the catastrophe theories and everything. But in fact, when you look at these catastrophe theories, many of them turn out to be based on poor research. But it's important overall to try and keep an optimistic outlook on things for this very reason, because of this concept that we do have a potential of actually creating the future by mass concentration on it. I mean, it's a well-known phenomenon in the area of medicine, where, you know, if someone is optimistic about their recovery, they're accepted as being much more likely to recover.
Yes.
And you could say that the Earth itself is in a position now where it's kind of ill, and if we can all concentrate on a recovery, it's much more liable to happen.
That's a good. I think that's a good approach, and healthy as well, because I mean, you mentioned that many of these catastrophe, you know, theories, so to speak, are poorly researched. Tell us a little bit more about that, because that's very interesting. One thing that I've been encountering, of course, is that, you know, in 2003, Planet X is going to head by, and in 2005, we're going to have a pole shift, and, you know, on and on we go. But, you know, here we are again, in a way. We have potentially maybe a little bit more hurricanes. I don't know if that's true or not. Some people say that there are more volcanic activity, but at least not it's not as catastrophic as I imagined, you know, many years ago. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I've looked at the increasing Earth changes, and I did check up Michael Mandeville's produced some graphs that he got from an earthquake information center, and I checked that information on a different earthquake information center, and it very closely followed his conclusion that over the recent years we do have an increase in seismic activity. There was a slight bump on the graph that on the information database that I followed, which wasn't on his one, but generally it was very close. So, yeah, I do think that the Earth changes are increasing, but something I found, I mean, have you heard anything about Alexei Dmitriev's work?
No, I might have heard about his work, but I don't recognize his name. Tell us about it.
Alexei Dmitriev is a Russian geologist, and he's written a paper which is on the Millennium Group website, actually, and he specializes in also in looking at what he calls vacuum domains. This is, broadly speaking, it's what we call balls of light. So he's made a study of those, of which there are, there's over 10 different varieties. They've all got slightly different combination of properties, but generally speaking, they emit quite a high electromagnetic field, which interferes with electronic devices. They're plasma balls,
uh-huh.
And they go in and out of the visible spectrum, and they can travel through solid objects. But they've all got slightly different combination of qualities depending on how they're classed. There's earthquake lights and, you know, will-o'-the-wisps, and there are a whole bunch of these that have been photographed interacting with crop formations. But there are, well, there's those Foo Fighters. That was another instance of them. On my website, I think I have got a link. Well, I've definitely linked to it in the references in the book. Another paper that's on the Millennium Group site by Dmitriev, where he's studying these various types of balls of light. Basically, that fits in with the other material that he's put out, which is, he starts off in this paper saying that the Russians have been sending satellites up for some years to look at the edge of the heliosphere, and that there is a huge build-up of interstellar plasma that's collected on the edge of the heliosphere, which is it's the edge of our solar system, beyond the furthest planets, where the sun pumps out its solar rays, and where those hit interstellar space, that's the edge of the heliosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And as the whole solar system goes through interstellar space, it's like a boat going through water. There's a bow wave at the front, and there's a build-up of stuff that gets caught on the front end. Deflects through, and some doesn't.
And this is our protective bubble, isn't it, from cosmic rays?
Yes. But there's this. Well, they found this massive build-up of interstellar plasma on the edge of the heliosphere, and he says that it's bleeding through to the sun, and then the sun is sending it out on its own equatorial plane, where it's affecting the atmospheres and magnetic fields of all the planets in the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just the Earth that is experiencing changes to the atmosphere and magnetism. It's happening on every single planet in the solar system.
Yes.
So, basically, he says it's down to this plasma, and he also says that we've got a sort of a huge plasma overdraft in the solar system, is what he calls it, and that it's building up in our atmosphere and causing an increase in these anomalous light phenomena, these balls of light, and that they, that's a whole another study as to how they're interacting with people, but...
Right.
It seems from other sources that these balls of light have many of the qualities of life itself.
Hmm.
They can be described, although they're only transient life forms, if they are life forms, they do seem to act just like living creatures for a short period of time in which they exist. So it could be that, they're... He calls them vacuum domains because there's one group of them that exist at the centre of tornadoes, tornado lights, and that is a vacuum. But it could be, because when a tornado is passed, you get a breaking of the laws of physics. You get all sorts of crazy things like sticks embedded into glass without breaking the glass or the stick, and straw also embedded in glass.
Right, right.
So
it changes. So
somehow these things.
It changes the molecular structure, maybe, of some material that are within this eye of the storm, if you will, then, maybe?
Yes, apparently. But, I mean, there has been a prediction by one of these people coming out of a near-death experience that around 2012 there will be a massive breakthrough in physics.
Okay. Hmm.
So it could be that whole... I mean, that also could be applied to one of McKenna's favourite theories, was that in 2012, time machines are constructed for the first time. So suddenly, all the time machines from the future will start suddenly appear on these leisure trips back into the past, but they won't be able to go beyond the point where time machines were invented.
That's awesome. I know also that McKenna, of course, talked about, Terence McKenna talked about AI, for instance, as well. You know, when we approach the point where we can, create, if you will, intelligences, that this will be a very weird experience, to say the least. And I think he attributed that almost to be similar to meeting an ET, you know, that this is going to be so foreign for us when this finally, you know, communicates with us in whatever way it will. And that consequently could also change very much our technological process, of course, if this machine comes online and consequently helps or decides not to help us and go in the opposite side, things could dramatically change, you know?
Yeah, and he was speaking also, I mean, from personal experience, really, because during his experiences on DMT, he actually described in detail his encounters with these creatures that he called tykes, or self-transforming machine elves of hyperspace, which he says, you go, in his experience of this, you go down into a sort of down a tunnel into a sort of an underground space that's lit from, you can't quite tell where, and it's full of these creatures that are like jewel-encrusted basketballs that are all chirping and squeaking, and they all rush up to you and try and communicate, and they encourage you to use your voice. And as you use your voice, you start to produce little sort of Fabergé egg-like encrusted jewel-filled objects, and you present them to these creatures, and they know exactly what you mean.
Oh my God!
I mean, that just sounds balmy, doesn't it? Really, but I mean, so coming from that perspective, I can see what he means by that.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. Yeah. We have so much more to talk about, and our first hour is almost up here soon, and I want to begin to round things off here before we continue talking more in our second segment, in our member section. But I do want to talk a little bit more about your book before we do that. So tell us a little bit about Beyond 2012, some of the things that you go into. I'd reckon that most of the stuff we've been talking about here today is things that you bring up in the book. Is that correct, Jeff?
Yes, it is. There's one or two little things that have happened since the book came out, but I mean, I hadn't actually got into that in this discussion yet. But yes, I talk the first. I've sort of split the book into four parts. It starts talking, because most people are keyed into this with the Maya calendar. I start the book off by explaining how the Maya calendars work, and then goes into tribal prophecies, not just of the Maya, but various other tribes from all over the world who have prophecies that seem to correlate pretty exactly with this time we're in. And in some cases, they actually mention 2012 specifically. Mm. Then it goes into other calendars that seem to concur with this. And then it goes into McKenna's I Ching and how that was all calculated, which is fairly complex. And then it just the next last chapter of part one is about the Abrahamic religions, which is how all this fits in with the three religions of Abraham. That's Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Mm. And yes, there's some surprises there as well. And then the second part is about 2012 theories, and it goes into sunspot cycles and various astronomical cycles that people have tied in and tried to explain the whole Maya calendar and the timing of it and everything with various astronomical phenomena. Then alternative archaeology, that's the findings of people who've been looking at, people like Hancock and Bovall have been looking at the Giza pyramids, and they've tied that into the Maya calendar in 2012. And other people who've sort of developed those mainly alternative Egyptian archaeology ideas, where they've tied in Egypt. And I cover the work of Patrick Gerrell and Gino Ratings as well, mm-hmm. who you may have come across, although I do actually disagree with them. I found two areas where I disagree with them, and I think that they've made an error. Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, that's kind of... it's derailed the whole theory, as far as I'm concerned.
maybe we can talk a little bit more about that in the next segment, because that's interesting, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, after that, I go on about, I talk about the geomagnetic field changes and about the Milankovic cycle, which is ice cycles, and then ice cores that indicate that around 3114 BC there was a big climate change, so that maybe the end of the beginning of the Longkhau calendar was based on a sort of geomagnetic or geological boundary. Mm. And I go into fringe science, where people take science a little bit further beyond where it's normally taken to talk about 2012. And in part three, talk about shamanism, the various kinds of altered states of consciousness that people have gone into via various kinds of sacred plants and drugs, and other altered states with out-of-body experiences, meditation, past life recall. And then I talk about the alien abductions and other phenomena to do with UFOs, that where that's sort of spin-offs of that have been applied to 2012. Mm. And then crop circles, where people have applied various meanings to crop circles that are significant to 2012.
Yes.
And then it goes into the secret government, that's the Montauk Project, basically, with remote viewing. And then I look at the prophecies of Nostradamus, and then I look at some various, where things have got a little bit wacky in some of the New Age theories. And that's where I include Carl Kellerman's material there, and some of Jose Arguelles' perspectives also. And then the final part is called the diagnosis, where I split it into an analysis, a synthesis, and a prognosis, where I go through what we've looked at throughout the book and sort of analyze it and see if it holds together. But I also bring in some new material, a lot of it to do with ancient perspectives from Neolithic people, which seems to sort of help explain it all.
Interesting. You know, we have much to talk about here in the next segment, but, you know, again, the book is called Beyond 2012, Catastrophe or Ecstasy. The best way to get a copy is that to go to Amazon, I guess. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you can get it direct from Amazon.co.uk, or you can get it on Amazon.com, but they don't do it directly, but they do it through the dealers that basically you get it the same as you would look up anything else on Amazon, and there it is. But it doesn't come directly from Amazon if it's the Amazon.com. But next year it is coming out in America, so it will be on there directly. But they're changing the title to Catastrophe or Awakening.
Okay.
For the American audience, they prefer that combination.
Okay. But, there we go. And the website, of course, I want to mention again, Diagnosis 2012. That's 2012.co.uk, Diagnosis 2012. And also, before, if we have potential any listeners from Italy tuning in, you'll be going to Rome for a lecture in during this weekend, isn't that correct?
That's right, yes. John Major Jenkins is also speaking there in Rome. And you'll find the link for that on my events page. I've also got a MySpace page, actually, where I've got the advert for that as well.
Okay, beautiful. We're going to have those linked up from our information page in relation to this interview, so you can find more information about that in case you want to head over there and check out both Jeff and also John Major Jenkins then. But stay with us, Jeff, and thank you very much here for this first segment. We'll take a short break here, and we'll continue with more after our break.
Thanks.
Don't miss our second segment with Jeff Stray, now available in our member section. We'll talk more about crop circles, the apocalypse, solar flares, and the increasing solar activity around 2011-2012. We'll talk more about the energy or plasma that we mentioned here in the first segment and talk more about what it could be. We'll also discuss some of Jeff's findings when it comes to some of the catastrophists' approach to 2012. Dates, stars, astronomical alignments, what does it all mean, and what's Jeff's take on it all? And what can we do, if anything, to prepare? So more coming up with Jeff in the member section. If you're not a member, head on over to redicecreations.com, click on subscribe, and follow the simple steps, get instant access, and tune in. Our member section is filled with over 2 years of radio programs, extended interviews with many of our guests, video and film material, And of course, all our future upcoming live programs will be archived in their entirety in our member section. So again, I want to remind you, you want to tune in live. Don't miss this. This is on Sunday the 28th at 7 p.m. GMT. We'll be talking with Daniel Tatman and diving deeper into architecture and symbolism. Don't miss it. Thanks for tuning in to our first segment. We'll be right back after this break.